In 1810, the British frigate arrived in Montevideo with the news that Napoleon had invaded Spain and overthrown King Ferdinand VII. This caused a great deal of consternation in the viceroyalty of the River Platte, and there was a lot of expression of support for the legitimate Spanish king. Now, to be in favor of Ferdinand VII meant to be in opposition to those who were now, in fact, ruling Spain. And so, if the viceroyalty was a Spanish colony, supporting the deposed Spanish king became a de facto move towards independence. Now, this was a complicated situation because there you had a lot of cross-cutting cleavages. You had traditionals throughout Latin America, but certainly in Argentina as well, who had always been just a bit skeptical of the whole Bourbon dynasty ever since the Treaty of Utrecht, fearing that they had too much in common with French and with French ideas, specifically notions of enlightenment, whereas traditionalists had looked upon the Habsburgs as representing more traditional Hispanic and Catholic values. So they had always been suspicious of that. They had been suspicious of Ferdinand VII, actually, for being part of alleged conspiracies, even to encourage further French influence, and even looking for help from Napoleon before his eventual overthrow. So traditionalists had been skeptical of the Bourbons in general. They had been skeptical of Ferdinand VII's own liberal leanings, and wanting to return to the true values of the old Habsburg notion of dynasty. So you had traditionalists. Liberals in Buenos Aires were restive under the Bourbons because the Bourbons wanted to rationalize administration. They wanted to tighten up on the taxation and trade rules, and liberals were more influenced and attracted to notions of free trade. They wanted to trade with the British, and the British wanted to trade with them, as well as with the Portuguese and the Brazilians and whoever else, whereas the Bourbons wanted to sort and tighten up on mercantilist policies. So liberals were rather unhappy with the Bourbons and with Ferdinand VII as well. So you had a number of groups in Argentina who were sympathetic towards calls for independence for their own reason. The overthrow of the king then led to this perplexing notion that to call for independence was in fact a traditionalist objective of trying to help restore at least a somewhat more legitimate dynasty. As problematic as the Bourbons were, at least they would be better than Napoleon's brother Joseph, who ended up getting put on the throne in Spain, to have someone so directly under French control without any dynastic legitimacy at all was quite an unhappy situation for Argentine conservatives. So starting in 1810, you have efforts by the Cabildo, the local town council of big property owners in Buenos Aires. The Cabildo now is right across from the Casa Rosada in the Plaza de Mayo, right next to the main cathedral in Buenos Aires. Starting in 1810, the big property owners who met there started calling for support of Ferdinand VII, which de facto meant independence from the illegitimate government of Spain. And so you start to have independence movements. The British had been interested clearly in supporting Latin American independence movements before. This reaction to the news of the Napoleonic invasion of Spain was not completely unpredictable. And no doubt the British frigate which showed up in Montevideo with that news was sent with an eye to this sort of response. Now, as we've already mentioned, it's not the very first time that the British have done what they could to try to help usher Spain out of Latin America. A few years before this, in June of 1806, we had mentioned that Britain's Lord Beresford had, in fact, invaded Buenos Aires, briefly conquering it before the loyalist forces were able to force him back out. This rather direct military attempt to take over South America was not well received by the Spanish traditionalists or even liberals in Latin America. Liberal mercantilists and merchants in the capital were interested in trading with Britain. They weren't interested in getting taken over militarily by them. So this more indirect route of trying to spread information that would have a certain effect was certainly more sophisticated and much more successful than the military invasion. And Britain would learn rather significantly from this that its direct military colonialization of Latin America in most cases would be unnecessary and probably counterproductive. As a rule, Britain, in fact, did not go this route, even though they followed very much neo-colonial policies of gaining access to Argentina through diplomatic and economic tactics rather than military ones in the future. Well, whether intended or not, the response to the news brought by the British frigate was impressive. You have, from 1810 to 1811, two military campaigns that the Argentine patriots start to initiate. You have Antonio González de Balcarce carrying out the so-called Alto Peru campaign from 1810 to 1811, in which he tries to take over some of the sectors in Upper Peru. You have the famous Battle of Suipacha, which is a great victory for the Argentines, although that leads to the more unsuccessful Second Battle of Huaqui. And then you have the Paraguay campaign in the same years, 1810 to 1811, commanded by Manuel Belgrano. Belgrano being the fellow after whom the ship, which is going to end up being sunk in a famous battle in the Falklands War, was named. In 1810, 1811, his militia made its way up to Paraguay, a campaign which also ended up failing, but clearly the Spanish forces, the loyalist, royalist forces, had their hands full on the mainland of the viceroyalty of the River Plate, and the decision was made that the small Spanish force way out on the Falkland Islands, or the Malvinas, was not where they were primarily needed. And so, in 1811, the Spanish forces on the Falklands were withdrawn, also leaving a plaque asserting that Spain continued to claim sovereignty over these islands, but that these forces were just being redeployed towards more pressing needs on the mainland. But one way or the other, you once again had the abandonment of these islands. The British had abandoned them a few decades before, and now the Spanish were abandoning them again, and the islands are unoccupied, with claims having been made back in 1774 by Britain to them, and now in 1811 by the Spanish. But of course, whatever the claims were, in either case, both countries had in fact left the islands. Now, the situation on the mainland throughout this independence period was not any more clear. You did have the declaration back in 1810 by the Cabildo to overthrow, to remove the viceroy from power, and to form the first junta, Primera Junta. But that Argentina would not more formally declare its independence from the Spanish crown for another 6 years on July 9th of 1816. That declaration of Independence was made by the Congress of Tucumán, which was a congress at which the representatives from the various areas of the viceroyalty were to have met. Now, later on, there's a principle of iudi possidetis, which the increasingly now independent viceroyalties will start to appeal to, which simply said that the territory of the new independent nation should more or less correspond to the territory of the viceroyalty when it was a colony being administered by Spain. And so those territories that were part of a viceroyalty would now be part of the new independent nations. However, of course, one of the fundamental political issues in Latin America right after independence from Spain is the fragmentation that there were at first, for most of the Spanish colonial period, there were only two of these viceroyalties, and then starting in the late 18th century, they add a couple of more. But the newly independent nations do not really correspond to any of them. They break up into a number of nations in every single case. And you had a process, for reasons we won't get into here, that led to the same thing in what becomes Argentina. There are territories in the viceroyalty that, for whatever reasons, don't send delegates to the Congress of Tucumán, including what is the Banda Oriental, the Eastern Bank, or what we call Uruguay, as well as Paraguay and Gran Chaco and Mesopotamia. They are not sending representatives there, and so the Declaration of Independence is more of what is now Argentina rather than that entire viceroyalty, and perhaps even more of what is Buenos Aires rather than all of what is Argentina. Now, so the Declaration of Independence itself is a harbinger of the types of instability that the region is going to be facing for a long time. And obviously nobody from the Malvinas or the Falklands is sending any representatives. There's nobody there to send. While at least some of the provinces are sending their representatives to the Congress of Tucumán, the British are sending goods of various industrial types to Argentina throughout the independence period in return for minerals, raw leather, and eventually that mix of goods will include various foodstuffs, grains, and meat eventually. But that just shows that both Britain and the Spanish and the Patriots of Argentina, they are concentrating on this rather confusing mix of events that goes on throughout the independence period, which lasts for a number of years. In the meantime, their attention is certainly not on these small islands way off the coast of Argentina. Not everybody's ignoring them, however. Sealers, whalers, fishermen of various nationalities find the islands a convenient place to dock and to weather storms and so on. And so you start to have little informal communities. Nobody's declaring sovereignty over this territory. They're simply making use of land in which there are no national forces in control. Well, finally, 10 years after the first junta is formed in Buenos Aires, and 9 years after the Spanish forces had withdrawn from the Malvinas, a fellow by the name of Colonel Daniel Jewett from Buenos Aires decides that he might make another attempt to go out and take possession of these islands, and so he gets authorization from the government, such as it exists in Argentina, to go to the Malvinas and to assert its it's control over this, appealing to this principle of iudi possidetis. The Argentina has declared its independence. It's claiming that it can control territory that the viceroyalty had controlled. Of course, as we know, it in fact is not going to succeed in exercising sovereign control over large swatches of that territory, Uruguay, Paraguay, parts of Bolivia, and so on. In fact, there's a real question over whether the government in Buenos Aires has any meaningful control over most of the territories of what is now considered to be Argentina. There's no guarantee that Salta and Jujuy and all of these other provinces were going to end up within that nation, and there certainly was no guaranteeing that the Malvinas would either, but this was the idea. And so he shows up on the islands in November of 1820, and he finds 50 vessels of various nationalities who are working, staying on the islands and working from them to go fishing and whaling and so on. Anyway, he notifies all of them that he is taking possession of the islands in the name of the newly independent Republic of Argentina. Now, one could ask, which government of Argentina? There would be dozens of them over the next few years. And the rather extraordinary instability in Buenos Aires could lead one to question whether or not anybody could act meaningfully in the name of the Argentine government hundreds of miles from shore. But nevertheless, that's what Jewett was claiming he could do. 3 years later, in 1823, in the midst of this period of kind of a round robin of governments in Buenos Aires, the Argentine government did appoint a governor of the Malvinas, and he claimed the right to regulate fishing around the islands as well as settlements on the islands. This new governor of the Malvinas gives a concession of land on East Falkland to investors, Don Jorge Pacheco and Luis Vernet, so that they can establish a cattle and fishing business. Their efforts fail largely because all of these foreign vessels who were operating and intended to continue operating as they had for over a decade had no intention of recognizing these two as enjoying the exclusive rights to these businesses. But whatever the fishermen and the sealers were of foreign nationalities wanted, clearly the very fledgling government of Argentina was doing what it could to exercise sovereignty over territory which it claimed to have inherited from Spain back when Spain ruled that as part of its viceroyalty. It's in this period here, 2 years after these events, that you have Great Britain and Argentina signing a treaty of amity, commerce, and navigation. This is signed in 1825. The purpose of the treaty is to make sure that there can be freedom of commerce enjoyed between these two countries. And Article 1 of the treaty states that, quote, there shall be perpetual amity between the dominions and subjects of His Majesty the King of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland and the United Provinces of Rio de la Plata and their inhabitants. Now, this is in effect a recognition by Great Britain of the independence and the sovereignty of Argentina. One doesn't sign a treaty, a formal international treaty, with a bunch of rebel brigands. So it does not directly say that they recognize their independence, but it obviously implies that. And there's nothing in the treaty reserving the rights of Britain to regarding the Falklands or asserting its claim to this territory. It's simply silent on the issue. So the facts were that the Argentine government had appointed governors, was seeking to exercise effective control over the islands, however unsuccessfully still at that point, but it was clearly moving to that. And when Great Britain does sign a treaty with the newly independent country of Argentina, it makes no reservations, makes no statements about this, which doesn't necessarily mean it accepts it either, but it at least it does not establish its claim to the islands in this treaty. Well, the perpetual amity, which Article 1 called for, lasted about 4 years because in 1829 Britain did decide to renew its claim to the Falklands. Now, the events that led to Britain's renewed claim in 1829 started a few years before that. You remember Vernet was this fellow who had tried to establish a business, and the first attempt after 1823 didn't do well because he ran into all of this opposition from these kind of independent foreign vessels that were operating on the islands. He takes a second crack at it. He has a second expedition in 1826. In which he had gotten a concession, again granted by the Argentine government, and he seeks to establish his business interest there on the Falklands, and he runs into some of the same problems. So to give Vernet more authority, on the 10th of June of 1829, the Argentine government grants his request for an exclusive grant of fisheries on the Malvinas, and the grant claims that the islands had belonged to Spain when the revolutionary movement was begun, and that the new government claimed inheritance of Spain's rights over the islands, and it appoints Vernet governor, and it intends to actually try to gain some control over this kind of Wild West situation that that existed on the islands. Well, Britain wasn't going to attack about this issue, but they would go so far as exchanging a few diplomatic notes in response to all of this. A few months after the 10th of June Argentine decree given to Vernet, Woodbine Parish, the British chargé d'affaires in Buenos Aires, protested on the 19th of November of 1829, saying that in fact the British did still claim title to the Falkland Islands. He wrote that the British claim was based on first discovery, occupation, the restitution of Port Egmont, and the intention to resume occupation as indicated by the plaque that had been left in 1774. But Britain did nothing beyond having made this diplomatic protest. Vernet, on the other hand, kept pressing ahead and actually was starting to get somewhere. His little colony had started to thrive a little bit. He had trained his horses to run on the soft island soil. He's had up to 20,000 wild cattle on the islands. He was supplying the foreign ships there with beef. He was exporting some beef and fish to Brazil, exporting some wool to London. He intended to tame all of the wild cattle that was there. His little colony had grown to about 90 settlers. He considered himself to be a rather cultivated man. His library had books in Spanish, German, and English, and his wife impressed the sailors with her singing. Vernet was demonstrating that he had some business sense. A rather gentlemanly Argentine businessman had become confident enough to try to tame not only the wild cattle on the Falklands, but also the rather more unruly fishermen, which prompted a series of events which did provide the English an opportunity to move beyond mere diplomatic notes. in an attempt to enforce the fishing regulations that had been approved by the Argentine government. Vernet seized two ships that were violating these regulations. One of them had been warned back in 1829 against violating the regulations, but then it had returned in 1831. The other ship was required to give security against its reappearance and then was released. The problem was that both of these ships were from the United States. In fact, one of them, the Harriet, had its captain captured, and he was brought to Buenos Aires to stand trial. The U.S. representative in Buenos Aires, John Forbes, had recently died, and there was a new representative by the name of George Slaycomb that had just replaced him. Slaycomb was just indignant about what Vernet had done, and he wrote to the Argentine Minister of Foreign Affairs saying that he could not imagine what gave Vernet the right to capture an American ship to engage in what was clearly lawful trade, and simply rejected the decree of the 10th of June of 1829, under which Argentina claimed it could regulate fishing off the islands. Slaycomb discussed this problem with the British Consul General, Woodbine Parish, and Parish told him that Argentina had no legitimate claims to the islands, that the British claim had never been surrendered, and that Britain intended to revive their rights when it was convenient. Slaycomb was a little disquieted by what England might do, but the Argentine affront to the United States was much more immediate. And, more importantly, the USS Lexington happened to be in Buenos Aires at the time, and its captain, Silas Duncan, discussed the crisis of the day with Slaycomb. Duncan, too, was indignant about the whole matter, and he declared that it was his duty to protect American citizens who were engaged in rightful and legal trade. Slaycomb informed the Argentine government that Duncan, the captain of the Lexington, would sail to the Falklands if U.S. property was not promptly restored. And in fact, on the 28th of December of 1831, Duncan arrived aboard the Lexington just off of Puerto Soledad. He and his men go ashore, they take the colony's weapons, they burn its powder, they raise the buildings, they seize some seal skins, and they arrested most of the inhabitants. He declared the islands res nullius, without government, and left with six of the Argentines in chains, who were then freed in Montevideo. The Buenos Aires government complained to Slaycomb about the incident and the irregular use of language in his own official notes. In fact, it would request that Slaycomb be replaced, which Slaycomb rejected. And then the Argentine government refused to deal with him. Now, if the Argentines expected any better treatment from any other U.S. official, it turned out to be quite mistaken. President Andrew Jackson, when he received word of the incident, he was very irritated by the whole event. He said in his annual message of December 6th of 1831 that a band of pirates had pretended to act under the authority of the government of Argentina, which clearly would not have supported such outrages. And he urged Congress to provide a naval force adequate to protect American fishing and trading in the South Atlantic. The U.S. Secretary of State, Edward Livingston, said that Vernet's acts were lawless and piratical. The new chargé d'affaires, who had replaced Slaycomb in Buenos Aires, Francis Baylis, was instructed to inform the Argentines that the United States had the perfect right to freely use the fisheries on the oceans and the unfortified bays, gulfs, and inlets. Baylis also told the British minister, Fox, that the United States laid no claim to the island, only to the right of fishing there. The United States, he said, would maintain this right against Britain as well as Argentina. Now, the British were no doubt somewhat unamused by the American position regarding all of this. Now, remember the context for this. It was just a few years before that the Americans, under President Monroe, had issued the famous doctrine in 1823, saying that the United States would not accept any new European colonization of any territory in the Western Hemisphere. Now, the British and most Europeans were wondering at the time just exactly what military forces the United States would use to enforce such a grandiloquent policy. And as it turns out, in fact, for most of the rest of the century, America really didn't take that policy terribly seriously, except in the Caribbean and on its borderlands. As it turns out, it was interested really in gaining territory in North America and eventually in playing a role around the canal, and which would become the Panama Canal, and then the naval routes giving access to that canal. It really didn't care too much exactly what happened in South America. But here in 1831, it was indicating that it was looking as far south as the South Atlantic and was getting involved in the political affairs of the Southern Cone. Now, this was something that Britain was not much interested in. They did not see the United States as a nation that should be projecting its military power as far south as South America. It would be some years, in fact, before the British would be prepared to permit the United States to have even an equal role to it in Central America. So if Britain was to make sure that the United States was not to start claiming an active military role as far south as the Falkland Islands, it was time perhaps to move ahead on their own. And so two British warships, the Clio and the Tyne, arrive at Port Egmont on the 10th of December of 1832. And a few weeks later, on the 2nd of January of 1833, the Clio anchors right off of Port Louis. Now, Port Louis and the rest of the Malvinas was in a bit of an uproar. After Vernet had been sent away from the islands due to the American actions, the Argentines had responded by appointing another governor to succeed him, Juan Mestivier. And he was also to take charge of the penal colony that was established at San Carlos in East Falkland. But he didn't have much more luck than the rest of the Argentines in establishing stability on the islands. There was a mutiny, and then there was a jailbreak, and poor Mestivier ended up being murdered. So there was some chaos going on the islands as the British showed up. Now, a loyalist to the Argentine government, Don José María Pinedo, had control of a ship, the Sarandí, and his crew had just tracked down Mestivier's murderers. And he did hope to maybe exercise some influence over the British as well. But he was informed by the British that they intended to exercise the British right of sovereignty over the islands. And they, in fact, raised the British flag there on the 3rd of January. Pinedo protested, and he was thinking of maybe trying to fight the British over the issue, but a lot of his own soldiers or sailors were in fact British nationals. Now, there was nothing all that unusual at the time, of course, about nationals from one country acting as mercenaries for another, and in fact Britain was prepared to accept that. The only limitation was that British nationals could not fight against British forces without being guilty of treason, which was a capital offense, and so many of these sailors sailors under Pinedo's authority were simply unwilling to fight the British, and so beyond protesting what the English were doing, there wasn't much more that Pinedo could do, and so the British flag went up, and the Sarandi under Pinedo sailed off on the 5th of January with all the soldiers and convicts of the penal colony and those remaining Argentine settlers who wished to leave. And with all of this, we have, in fact, the restored British presence on the Falkland Islands. If one understood this to be the establishment of a new colony, then one could think that the Monroe Doctrine should have been applied in this case, and the Americans should have objected to a new colony, a new European colonization of territory in the Western Hemisphere. However, as we've mentioned, in practice, the United States really was less interested in this, and in fact sort of fades out of the picture in the Falkland Islands after these events. Presumably they could have said that this was just not a new colony, but it was a reassertion of Britain's older colonial presence on the Falkland Islands. But it becomes sort of a peripheral to the whole story anyway. Instead, what we have then after 1833 is the British occupation after this rather undramatic military takeover, a military takeover in which, in fact, no shots were really fired, but still, military force was used insofar as it was demonstrated, and found to be overwhelming, and so the Argentines retired after not a dramatic show of opposition. And we have then, from 1833 until the present, the de facto control and occupation of the Falkland Islands by forces loyal to Great Britain.